Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in University of Texas Medical School versus Thong.
May it please the court, Mr. Neil Barnes will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. James Powell will present rebuttal.
Honorable Justices, may it please the court. The case before you today concerns Texas constitutional question on the amount of due process that is going to be afforded a student in a professional setting, in this case specifically a medical student, in regards to charges brought against him for academic dishonesty or cheating. The critical issues before this court is what is going to be the Texas constitutional standard. There's an absence of state constitutional law in this matter, and the direction that the court gives today will be fundamental and important to courts throughout the state.
So you're making no claim in the U.S. Constitution?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Than initially had brought his claim purely in the Texas Constitution. Now, briefly, the facts of the case are as follows. Mr. Than was a medical student enrolled in the University of Texas Medical School at Houston. February 22, 1991, he, along with some other fellow students, were taking a National Board of Medical Examiners examination. These are routinely administered to medical students throughout their career. During the course of that exam, two proctors came to believe that, in fact, Mr. Than was cheating. That was later reported to university administration, specifically to the Dean of Students, Dr. Margaret McNeese, who instituted an investigation, that specifically being requesting a statistical analysis by the National Board of Medical Examiners and comparing the test that Mr. Than turned in with the test from the student he allegedly copied or cheated from. The courts below found that during this process and after a hearing that Mr. Than relieved at school, that his due process rights were, number one, violated, and number two, violated to an extent that this due process violations were incurable, that there was nothing that could be done to give Mr. Than process, and therefore, in essence, ordered that he be given a medical degree as well.
How would you articulate the standards that you would have this court apply, the due process standards? Would you articulate for us what the standards should be in your view?
Yes. The standards should be something, first of all, that a non-lawyer school administrators can address these type of disciplinary problems, these type of academic problems, with some degree of certainty. That's the first thing. The second thing is, it needs to be a standard wherein, as I put it, non-lawyers can address the standards, and it not be so hyper-technical that what we do is turn our schools from classrooms into courtrooms. It also needs to be a standard that will give a student a fair right to state his position and to know the charges against him. But it also needs to be a situation where there is some deference to the school and a balancing of interest. And indeed, that's what due process traditionally has been about.
I'm asking you to articulate specifically what should the due process standard be for these types of cases.
Right. The federal standard typically is, in broad terms, from the Goss v. Lopez case, is a notice of the charges against you and an opportunity to respond either in writing or orally to the decision maker. Typically that has been categorized as something of an informal give and take and not required trial-like strictures. Within that context, this court is free to construct as broadly or as specifically as it would like, but clearly there needs to be some way for administrators to have some flexibility with the administration of their schools, but yet still preserve the students' rights to confront the charges against him and then to move ahead with the decision maker and have some interaction to present his side of the story. There also needs to be some understanding, again, as I pointed out, that it's not going to be so technically complex that school administrators have to also become lawyers or judges themselves and able to administer and function in dealing with the school.
If you talk about notice simply in conjunction with an opportunity to respond, would opportunity to respond encompass sufficient, well, I guess, an opportunity to respond to the evidence that the accusers are planning to submit? In other words, there's a complaint here about the statistical analysis that apparently the hearing officer relies heavily on, and Stan now says this is he did not have it in time to have an opportunity to have experts look at it and come back with expert witnesses to challenge that information. Would a standard of opportunity to respond include, as part of that, an opportunity to address the evidence that's going to be presented?
Well, yes. I mean, in some sense it would. You always should be entitled to address the evidence presented against you. The federal courts who have delved into the due process issue regarding students and these sort of disciplinary hearings and complaints have set a standard wherein if you are confronted at the point when that evidence is presented to the decision maker and then have opportunity to respond and have opportunity to present your side of the story. It's important to understand that Mr. Than was told and given the documents of the statistical analysis. What he complained about and what the courts below said was that, number one, he wasn't aware of some oral conversations that had taken place between Dr. McNeese and the NBME, the National Board of Medical Examiners staff that did the analysis. So when she orally spoke to that, he had not previously heard that. But on a confrontation basis, the federal courts have found that that is sufficient, that because Mr. Than was present at that oral testimony, that he could confront that. The second part of the analysis complaint was in regards to the methodology that was used by the National Board of Medical Examiners. But the record below will show that that methodology was never relied upon. It was never presented to the hearing officer. It was never made a document or even oral evidence in the case as to how they constructed and how they arrived at their statistical basis. Again, Mr. Than, at his hearing, challenged the statistics and challenged those that were presented and had that right. Furthermore, in terms of...
I guess maybe I'm a little bit confused. If the proponent puts forth a conclusion and doesn't submit the underlying documentation, you're saying that the mere presentation of the conclusion satisfies the opportunity to respond by the accused?
I'm saying that there was a sufficient ability, for example, for him to point out to a hearing officer and a fact finder that we don't know what the methodology is, this could be faulty, let me tell you why, this sort of thing. And in fact, that's what Mr. Than did. He was able to challenge that statement in those conclusions. Again, focusing on what the process was and what his opportunity to respond was, he was given a chance to do that and in fact did so.
Would you include the regents' rules and regulations in the process that the university should follow?
I think as a matter of the constitutional question before us, that the courts would be unwise to get into what I guess we might describe as micromanaging schools by every rule and every regulation that is put down, because what's before the court here today is a broader constitutional concept. What would happen then is every time a school made the error on any number of rules, and in drafting their rules, there could be a challenge. If, for example, a school provides in an appellate process, as Mr. Than was given, 10 days to respond or they would lose that right, well, should it be 10 days? Should the courts come in and say, no, 11 days is enough? I think you need to deal in a broader context and focus on the issues of the student's ability to respond to the charges against them, to have that confrontation before the decision maker in regards to the evidence, but also have the school have the flexibility to deal with it as a school administrator as opposed to functioning as courts.
It suggests that these rules come from non-lawyers,
right,
who take that into consideration.
I think the Regents' rules are instructive. It might be instructive to this court to note, in terms of some of the distinctions pointed out in the court below, that as this was a National Board of Medical Examiners test, it was run pursuant to their rules, which deviated to a certain extent to what UT regulations might normally provide. In either case, it really boils down to, were the constitutional guarantees protected? And even though there may be a dispute about specific rules in terms of the courts watching each and every rule, we're going to have to focus on the broader context of the constitutional protections. Otherwise, the courts will be, in essence, administering the rules of the schools every time there's a challenge to each one.
From your argument, it appears you're conceding that there is some property interest in the right to continue the medical school. I did not get that from your brief.
No, Your Honor. We're not conceding that there is a property interest, but have proceeded on the assumption, as has been gone from the courts below, that there has been an assumption of a property interest. The other question, of course, would be, to what degree is that property interest exist? Is that property interest to the heightened level of, let's say, the property interest of a elementary school student who's legally required to go to school? And we would also think that's an important distinction for the court to consider.
And what's your position?
Our position is it has not really been decided as to whether or not there's a property interest in the school, but the school has proceeded to treat it as if he were entitled to at least some sort of due process hearing.
Do you know anything in the history or text of the Texas Constitution that would help us to decide whether there's a standard here that should be set constitutionally, and if so, how to set it, and how much to look at the development and how much to ignore it?
Well, I think it's important to understand, and as this court well does, that the Texas Constitution can certainly move to a higher standard than what is provided by the federal courts in reviewing the federal constitutional standard. But I think it's important to note that historically...
They can move to a lower standard, too.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
They can also move to a lower standard.
Right, as long as we satisfy the U.S. constitutional norm.
So he can only sit under the Texas Constitution. He doesn't sit under the U.S. Constitution. And we have to find that our Texas Constitution, regardless of the words or regardless of the intent of the framers, moves to provide whatever minimum due process the federal Constitution has.
I think it's consistent with it based on its history and based on the language. The Texas Constitution uses due course of law. The federal Constitution uses due process. Texas courts have previously found by way of comparison that the equal protection clauses of both the federal and the Texas Constitution are consistent. I think that other lower courts in this state have found that the due process clause, and we cite some of those cases in our brief, are consistent and equivalent to those things.
So you are arguing equivalency, or are you arguing that they're different?
Arguing that that would be a minimum standard. We would ask that the court be consistent with the previously established
is
standard.
Is it the same? UT's position that due process protection of the federal Constitution is identical to due course of law protection of the Texas Constitution, or are you saying it's different?
We're arguing that it should be the same, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. And I'm unclear still as to what your position is on whether there is a property interest in continued education and enrollment and graduation in medical school.
We have not briefed or reached a position as to whether or not there specifically has been a determination to be a property interest to maintain your enrollment.
I realize that, but now the question is, what is, we may have to cross that issue to decide this case. What is the state's position? There is or there isn't?
I would submit that to the extent that there is no contract relationship, that it is a voluntary relationship that a graduate student enters, that there should not be found to be a property interest.
So no due process is required at all?
If we base it on that and said that there is no property interest, then no, there would not be any due process to be required. But
in a professional school, as someone is graduating, in the process of graduating and trying to get professional credentials, the school could just expel them,
well, I
dismiss
think
them without any
right to notice of the hearing?
Well, I think in the most literal sense, if we're kind of saying, well, then if there has to be a property interest, how do we protect the interest of a student? I suppose at its base level, that might be the case. But there's no evidence that there would be any kind of arbitrary action like that, and the schools have not engaged in that.
Is there a contractual, any contractual right that a student at UT Medical School?
No, Your Honor, there is not. There is not.
I know there's no pleaded here, but there would, in Justice Corin's example, there would also be no contractual right. If I make all passing grades, you'll keep me in.
Not per se. And a good case in point is in medical schools, for example, there are other ethical considerations that are considered in terms of not just are you intellectually suitable, but are you ethically suitable. And those things are always going to be difficult and outside the purview of a process per se. One thing I'd like to bring the court's attention to as time runs down, though, this really important issue is the issue of incurability. And the fact that the lower court's finding is novel to the issue of due process and that the remedy was not more process, but the remedy was to award Mr. Than a degree. And that the school, because of the found errors, was stripped of its ability to determine who should be a doctor and who should receive its medical degree. And that was taken away from it. The appeal to the president of the university was simply obliterated and rendered moot and irrelevant. They got one bite of the apple. And because of that, the court tied on its point about awarding the degree that incurability at the first stage of the hearings with Mr. Than, that one chance, rendered all other efforts to cure and give Mr. Than due process to be null and void. That's simply an impossible standard that we ask this court to correct. If there are no further questions.
I'm curious, what is the status at the moment of Mr. Than and any other medical school?
Mr. Than completed his actual degree requirements, hour requirements, if you will, under orders from the court below, but has not received a medical degree.
And so has not been licensed?
No, Your Honor.
What type of evidence could a student come up with under these circumstances? You have the testimony of two proctors that they suspect him of looking at another student's paper. You have some statistical basis for saying that there was unusual amount of number of incorrect answers between this student's paper and the one that he allegedly looked at. But the examination, that same statistical data was inconclusive as to whether cheating took place or not. Is that correct?
I think ultimately it was deemed to be a difficult.
It was inconclusive.
To rely on that. It was some indication, but not conclusive.
It was inconclusive. If it wasn't reliable, it was inconclusive. Didn't exonerate him, but didn't convict him either. How does one rebut something like that, especially if in a very short period of time they receive notice that this statistical analysis has taken place when they may attack the methodology, but have they had time to examine the underlying methodology? They're not privy to conversations that took place between the examining board and the person who is effectively adjudicating whether or not this academic dishonesty took place. What are they to come up with? How are they going to rebut this? Saying he was pristine and sterling and totally pure. How would he rebut it?
Well, I think much in the way that Mr. Than attempted to. First of all, it's important for the court to keep in mind that Mr. Than, back in March, the hearing was April 18th, back in March was orally apprised that this statistical analysis had been done. Now, although he did not receive any documents or word to that effect, he was aware that that had occurred. He, at no point, sought any expert advice. And the testimony is clear from Mr. Than at trial that he kept
most of what was going on to himself. He sought no legal counsel. He sought no expertise. And apparently felt within himself that he was capable of challenging the statistics. Now, just to clarify something, too, understand that the conversations took place between the dean of students who presented the school's case, not the hearing officer. She again stated orally before the hearing officer what she had been apprised of. Again, Mr. Than, as a professional student and capable, responded and argued as to the lack of conclusiveness and was effectively able to attack, although maybe not persuasive, but was certainly presented with an opportunity to say, you know, this was the kind of comparison that went on, this was not statistically valid. So again, focusing on the process, he had advance notice. He knew that statistical analysis was coming down. We would have to presume that he's capable of assessing his ability to challenge those sorts of statistics.
Of course, if he'd had a lawyer, the lawyer probably would have objected to consideration at all because it could not establish anything.
Well, and ultimately upon appeal, when he had representation, that's exactly what happened.
Suggesting if they do get a lawyer right away and inject legal expertise into the process, they want to protect themselves.
No, Your Honor, I don't necessarily think that that's advisable. I'm saying that each person...
What confuses me, and I think what the court is seeking, is some standard for finding that indeed this merits expulsion in this or any other case. Is it just, hey, we think... under the circumstances, you probably did it, so we're going to boot you. Is there some standard of preponderance, perhaps not the reasonable doubt standard, but shouldn't there be some preponderance? What standard do we erect to enforce constitutional due process in situations like this? You've left us hanging and twisting in the wind. You say keep it informal, give them an opportunity to be heard, but let's not impose any standard for action on the part of the adjudicator. And this does carry with it a punitive consequences, and some processes obviously do.
I guess in terms of responding to the questions about the specificity of the standard, certainly I think that there is no case law that says exactly what that burden should be, first of all. Goss seems to indicate on the federal level some informal sort of give and take and an opportunity to respond. The ability of delineating exactly what that standard could be is going to have to, I guess, number one, take into account some of the discretion and the deference that is going to have to be given to school administrators. I guess the question is, could a reasonable person have not found that Than was not guilty of cheating? Was the hearing officer's finding unreasonable? Was there a level of evidence that would be sufficient for a finding of him being guilty as accused of the academic dishonesty? Clearly, in any sort of court context, if you had two witnesses and they were considered credible and the rest of the evidence would be presented, we judge in that same sort of light. Was it reasonable for them to find credibly that the proctor believed that he was cheating and that the statistical evidence was sufficient to, if you will, tilt those scales over to the side of believing that Mr. Than had indeed done what he was charged with? So being able to judge it from a reasonable kind of standard, was it reasonable conduct with due deference to the school?
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bruce Cohen will present argument to respondent.
May it please the court, this is truly a unique case. The facts of this case are totally different than any other published case that either we've cited or the petitioner has cited.
Could you tell me at the outset if your claim in argument two is solely on the Texas Constitution?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. In fact, that's how we were able to get it remanded back from federal court, stated that.
And the standard under the due course clause under the Texas Constitution is different? or the same as the federal standard and due process clause?
Well, to answer that, I looked into Vernon's to see exactly what the Texas Constitution said. And the comments, I think, were very helpful. On the first page of Vernon's, where it has the provision of Article 1, Section 19, the comments say that due process requires a fair and impartial trial. And then it goes on to say that included is an opportunity to be heard and reasonable opportunity to prepare for the hearing, which, of course, encompasses reasonable notice of the claim or charge. So it seems to be quite similar to what's been articulated as the federal standard.
So yeah. You would be satisfied with this court writing an opinion that says that the standard is identical?
I think I'd be most satisfied. Of course, I just represent Alan Fenn, so my concerns are that he can get on with his residency. But I think what I would like to see, as is often done in interpreting the Texas Constitution, that there are even some more rights that are given to students. The Texas Constitution gives more protection.
And on what basis would you make that argument? Based on the words that are used or the history?
More in the history adoption. And the way the Constitution has been interpreted.
Have you, there's nothing I think that I found in your brief that relates to that. Do you have anything to offer the court along those lines?
I have nothing at this time, Your Honor.
This court in 1887 said our procedural due process guarantee was identical to the federal court, and I don't believe this court's ever held differently on procedural due process.
And frankly, I'm not suggesting that you do that, because I think that the courts that have looked at this have found that using the federal standards, which you're stating is identical, using those same standards, the due process procedurally and I think substantively was violated here.
So you would be satisfied with our applying the federal standard?
I've been satisfied up to date so far, Your Honor, and I would hope that similar results would take place applying that same standard.
Well, I'm not asking about the result. I'm asking about the standard to be applied.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the standard has been a fair one that's been articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court. Professor Michael Olivas, and getting back to the uniqueness of this case, he wrote the casebook on higher education law that's used in law schools across the country. And in this particular case, writing both as an amicus and testifying in the court, said this was one of the worst cases of due process violations in higher education that he has ever seen. Frankly, if the state is going to be coming forward with a case to articulate a standard, it's not these sort of facts that I would think they want to have it articulated on. All of the cases that the Supreme Court and the U.S. Courts of Appeal have articulated have been horrible facts for students. Cases like one case from the Fifth Circuit, the Keough case, where the individual admitted that he had cheated. Cases like the Nash case, which they've heavily relied on, is a case where these students had been warned on several occasions before that they were believed to have been cheating on an exam. As two of the amicus wrote in this case, and one of them testified at trial, Dr. Abel on the faculty of the university said that Alan has enormous integrity. I've been dismayed by the actions taken by the medical school. Dr. Brosnan, another one of their own faculty members, came forward and said, though I suspect it is professionally dangerous, I am writing in support of Alan Fenn.
Counsel, are you referring to the letters we've gotten from doctors who were witnesses in the case? Are you referring to them as amicus briefs?
Yes, Your Honor. There are two amicus letters. Dr. Hebert, though, who in addition to writing the amicus letter, also testified at trial.
Do you know of any precedent for witnesses in the lower court proceedings writing letters to the Supreme Court and calling them amicus briefs?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I was copied with those letters, and I think I got a postcard from the court that referred to it as that. But no, I didn't check.
You referred to Professor Olivas as amicus, but he's not filed with this court.
I believe he had submitted a letter that the court sent me a postcard on. I think it dealt with him on whether the court should grant a writ of error. But he didn't file another one after that.
Mr. Conn, why wouldn't Mr. Fenn receive all the relief that he'd be entitled to under the claims that you have alleged by simply sending it back to the medical school and say start over, giving Mr. Thamm the opportunity to review the methodologies under the statistical analysis and have a fuller hearing on that. Why wouldn't that be the total, complete relief that he'd be entitled to?
Well, there have been a number of U.S. Supreme Courts that have addressed that issue. And it's really the issue of why not more process if the due process wasn't given the first time around. First of all, the Barry versus Barchi, it's a 1978 U.S. Supreme Court case, which talked about an exercise in futility where it involved the suspension of a horse trainer who needed a prompt hearing. The U.S. Supreme Court has talked about a hearing given at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. At this point, we are almost 4 years post-surgery NBME exam. The witnesses have scattered all over the country at this point. The witnesses being those who were there in the exam room, and who knows what they remember at this point. But we wouldn't have the power to bring any of these people back, whereas before they were available, and they could come forward to testify had Mr. Thamm known what evidence was going to be used against him.
But in terms of result, either there was cheating or there wasn't. If there wasn't, he had a grade on the exam.
Right, and that's the grade that ended up being awarded to him through the lower courts, and then he went on and completed his education.
So by going back through the hearing and allowing Ms. Thamm to attack the methodology of that, there's a potential the hearing officer would have a different conclusion, and everything is in place to have the granting of the degree. Your argument just is he might not be able to now find an expert that can attack.
No, it's the individual students that were there in the exam room. The hearing
that
officer.
That was a surprise to him that he would need the other students at the first hearing.
It wasn't so.
He
knew he needed
that then, and now he knows that now.
He knew he needed.
There was more statistical evidence that he wasn't aware of.
No, he knew he needed other students. In fact, he had some other students. At the hearing, though, because they presented these cheating allegations so late in the process, he wasn't sure where he was sitting and where these other students were sitting. He brought the wrong students to the hearing. And now the right students have all moved on, and chances are 4 years later, their memory's going to wane as to where they were sitting during this one particular exam.
Have you been able to identify the right students, as you call them?
Yes, we have. And in fact, at one point during the process, I invited the other side because I wanted to preserve what they had to say. I had a court reporter come by, and we questioned them. And so I've got their statements preserved. The problem is the other side complained, at least in the lower court, that they didn't have a chance to be there, and they didn't want to be there because they say their regents' rules don't provide for depositions and things of that nature, so they weren't going to allow that testimony. So that's the problem going forward 4 years hence, that these key witnesses are no longer available.
What property interest does a graduate student have in the education process that is protected by the Constitution?
His property interest, also a liberty interest. I think both of those have been articulated in previous case law. But those are interests that no one has really ever given great thought to. Even the U.S. Supreme Court, when they addressed it, said that it's assumed that an individual going to a state-supported school cannot have certain rights, again, rights that are assumed. I mean, I can't point to U.S. Supreme Court case law anyway that specifically says an individual has these rights. In fact, in the dissent in Goss versus Lopez, they kick around the issue of whether or not there's really this right there, but even the dissent didn't come out and say there is no property or liberty interest. I think everyone has just assumed that it's there.
You wouldn't have it in the private school.
No, I don't think so. Here we have state action. A private school would have the contract issue, I think.
On the issue of property interest, where does he now stand? He has completed all the work for an MD degree, but does not have the MD degree. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. He's not been given the degree. And even though he went through the process to obtain a residency and got the residency.
But all of that work indicates a passing grade. He has everything to get an MD degree except the degree itself. Is that correct?
That's correct. He went and he...
All right, now then, is that work transferable to another medical school that might give the degree? upon completion, perhaps some additional work?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, although just from past cases, I think as a practical matter.
The question I'm asking you is a matter of policy. Does the event that occurred preclude University of Texas from transferring that work to another school? Had he transferred, say, at the beginning of his last year, he would have gone ahead and completed his work.
But
is there any policy that keeps him from transferring that? And I'm trying to address the issue of property rights.
Yes, I understand. I don't think there's a policy, but there's a problem. You can't transfer without getting a transcript from the university. And the university, as you can see in the record, just...
Well, that's my question.
They won't give him anything.
They would not transfer his completed records to another school.
They won't do it.
And they've been asked to do that.
Sir?
Have they been asked to do that?
They've never been asked to transfer the records to another school. They've been asked to issue transcripts, to issue a dean's letter so he can start the residency. They will not do it. And that's why the lower court, based on this type of behavior, had to go to these great lengths to say, we want you to fully cooperate, we want you to give the degree that he's earned, because the court, who looked at all these issues throughout the case, saw how completely uncooperative the university was. They would not give him anything. And even when he completed all the coursework, he got the residency at the University of Virginia, they wouldn't give him the dean's letter, and they wouldn't give him the diploma so that he could take the next licensing exam that's done on a national level.
Has he completed his residency?
No, he can't start it, Your Honor, because they refused to give him the dean. There's something called a dean's letter saying that he's completed all his coursework, and they refused to give him the diploma.
He has not been involved in a residency program since the time
he was awarded it, and the University of Virginia waited a number of months, but they couldn't wait it.
How much time has elapsed at present?
I think it's about 3 years since he graduated and was ready to start that residency.
Your brief makes reference to a statistical expert that has examined Dr. Kelly's analysis.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that expert provided with the methodology, the underlying methodology?
Yes, Your Honor. Through discovery, we got all of that in.
Before their hearing, prior to the original hearing, when did Mr. Thann first ask for, and then when did he first receive the report?
The date of the hearing was April 18th of 91, and he first received some documents on April 12th of 91. But he was surprised, and this surprise is on the record of the hearing. He was surprised at the hearing when Dr. McNeese started testifying about these conversations and the methodology and all this other stuff. So he first learned about that at the hearing itself.
Did he ever ask for more time to be better prepared?
I'm not sure if he used those magic words. He expressed his surprise at the hearing. I guess a lawyer would know that surprise goes with a request for continuance and more time, but I don't think he couched it in those terms.
My point is, he apparently surprised in March that a report, a statistical analysis existed. Is that correct or not?
I don't think so. On March 18th is when Dr. McNeese discussed the cheating issue for the first time, and he wasn't even formally charged, though, until April.
When does the record reflect that he first asked for and then when he first received specifically this statistical analysis?
I think he asked for it from the NBME, which would have been after April 12th of 91, in that six-day period before the hearing. And the NBME refused to give him anything.
So was the first time he saw it at the hearing, or was it some prior date?
I'm sorry, I didn't
hear. Was the first time that he received it at the hearing, or was it some prior date when he first received the statistical report? I'm just trying to figure out.
He received the information about joint wrong answers, I believe, in the six-day period before the hearing. And then he received a lot more information about it at the hearing itself, and about other matters dealing with the statistical analysis. I would note that the decision of the Court of Appeals does not support the petitioner's death knell for schools throughout Texas. The, The decision of the Court of Appeals articulates and states exactly how due process for students has been handled, I think, since the first case in the 20s or 30s back in Massachusetts, which is basically, in many parts, they say due process requires only fundamental fairness. Courts should interfere only where there is a clear case of constitutional infringement. Due process notice must be appropriate to the nature of the case. There are no hard and fast rules. We're not asking this court to make hard and fast rules. Each case is decided on the basis of its own facts. This is truly a unique case. There is no other case from any court anywhere in the country that has facts anywhere similar to this. Nowhere. And the court, both the trial court and the appeals court, had to articulate specific relief that goes with the facts of this case.
Was there any evidence referred at any time regarding any other possible incidents of academic dishonesty on the part of Mr. Fox?
No. This was the only allegation ever against him.
And you say he was accepted for a residency at the University of Virginia Medical School?
That's correct. That's
pretty high standards there.
That's correct. The record also shows that he was an exceptional student. He had the University of Texas, Texas X's alumni scholarship. And this was a top
not,
student.
Not exactly an academic struggler who might commonly have need to cheat.
Correct. And that's what most of the other case law is about, academic strugglers. They cite one case out of Puerto Rico that talks about a trial judge who said he couldn't award a diploma as part of the relief. It really doesn't cite any case law that supports that proposition. But in that case, for an example, that was a master's student who had failed their thesis time and time and time again. This case is not like that. This case is not like the Horowitz versus Board of Curators. That was an academic dismissal case.
Assuming you're right, and there was a violation of Mr. Stan's due course rights here, you say we can decide this case based only on the facts, and it really doesn't necessarily implicate what's going to happen in schools throughout the state, other colleges, and professional schools, and that sort of thing. But doesn't the rent relief that you say that Mr. Fan's entitled to, that is, conferral of his degree in the dean's letter, perhaps, couldn't the same argument be made in every case of academic or disciplinary expulsion or suspension that once, due to the course of time, because people graduate and move to other parts of the country, that the unavailability of witnesses in order to prove one's innocence at the hearing merits all the relief you could ever have obtained rather than a new hearing?
Theoretically, that's possible. In the,
why wouldn't it be the same argument you made in every case?
Well, you know, in the 60 or so years that students have been bringing these cases to courts around the country, there's never been a case where that issue has even arisen, the conferral of the degree. Here, a court put him back in school because they realized the great injustice and unfairness of the proceeding. They put him back in school. He finished his schooling. He's not asking, like the case out of Puerto Rico, that the five professors who found that the person didn't know the elements of chemistry should not have a master's degree conferred on them. This is not that case.
You don't think that this court or any other Texas court ought to be hesitant about ordering an institution of higher learning to confer a degree?
Certainly this court should be concerned about things like that. In this particular case, based on these unique facts, Alan Fenn has earned the degree. He's supported by the faculty. He's completed all the coursework. He walked across the stage under court order at the graduation ceremony. This man is qualified, and there is no basis that the university has been able to articulate, other than this one alleged incident, that he's not competent to be a physician in the state of Texas.
Let me ask you. If a university adopts a no-tolerance position, no cheating whatsoever, can't the university do that? Can't they say that even a suspicion of cheating will be grounds for dismissal from the university. Couldn't they set that as a policy?
They certainly could.
So if that was the policy, does that make any difference as to what the standard of due process should be?
I mean, it's quite...
Should our standard of due process be relative to how you perceive to be the egregious results that occurred here? I mean, was the due process the egregious result that was achieved here, or was just because he has an exemplary record that there should have been a different standard of due process accorded to this type of circumstance than, say, some other circumstance?
So that's a tough question, because you're initially assuming that a suspicion of cheating would be a constitutional standard for a state school. And I'm not sure that suspicion alone, carrying a penalty of expulsion, would really meet constitutional standards. So I'm not sure. I mean, the bottom line is even if that was the standard, you're almost saying as a matter of law, he wouldn't even be entitled to a hearing. All they'd have to do is come forward and say, we suspect it, and he's out. But I think that would still be in the nature of a disciplinary expulsion, which would at least require the elements of a due process type of hearing. Let me just make one final point, if I may.
Your time has expired, so there'll have to be a question.
Well, I have a question, but it's not related to perhaps what you want to talk about. Have there been any attempts to settle this case by retaking the exam, or any conversation with the university?
Many. Well, many. We've always had the door open. Of course, at this point, I guess he'd be kind of scared 4 years after he'd probably want to take the course again at this point. But sure, he's always been open to that. He's always completed all of his coursework in a fine manner. And there's no reason to believe he couldn't pass this test just like he's passed every other test.
The university has always denied his request to retake the exam?
That's correct.
There was some reference to his failing his psychiatry course. Is that true?
There was reference to it. What he got was what's called a marginal pass on a portion of psychiatry, and marginal pass is still passing.
And he complained about that being brought up?
Definitely. Because as far as he was concerned, there wasn't any problem with that. And attached to our original petition, the first document filed in this case, is a letter from the psychiatry professor explaining that there was no significance at all to that marginal passing grade. And of course, he gives all the facts that support that conclusion.
What do you mean, no significance to the marginal passing
grade? Well, basically, he said that University of Texas at Houston has one of the highest, if not the highest, score requirement for a student in psychiatry. They require a 500. Other schools require much less. Allen got a 480. And that was only a portion. It was only like a third of his grade. And you don't get kicked out of school. It doesn't count as an F or anything like that. They just want you to retake the exam again and get that very, very high level that they require for psychiatry. And he explained that based on Allen's performance in the clinical rotation and all his other performances in the class, there was no reason to believe that he wouldn't get a higher grade. And in fact, I think the record shows that he did remediate that portion of it, and he did get that higher grade over the very high level of 500 that they set out.
What was the final point you wanted to make?
Thank you, Your Honor. The final point was just to point out that in the Goss v. Lopez decision, where it talks about the informal give and take, in the next paragraph, because that doesn't seem like a very high level of due process, in the next paragraph they go on to say that we should also make it clear that we've addressed ourselves solely to the short suspension not exceeding 10 days. Longer suspensions or expulsions for the remainder of the school term or permanently may require more formal procedures. So our position would be that, of course, this case is the expulsion, a permanent expulsion, and that more formal procedures that were referred to in Gosley Lopez would apply here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May I please report, Jean Todd.
Thank you. May it please the court, I think it's significant that so much of the respondent's argument, both in briefing and here before you, focuses on the results that happened, that Mr. Thon unquestionably was an excellent student, and unquestionably it's a tragedy that he might not complete his medical education and become a doctor. That is not the focus, though, of due process. The Texas Constitution guarantees due course of law. It doesn't guarantee either a perfect process or the right result all the time. So we would focus on the process that was followed. To return a moment to the question of what standard should be articulated, all the cases dealing with due process, state and federal, acknowledge that it does vary somewhat from situation to situation, so that we don't have the courts don't hand down exceptionally precise rules. However, there are some principles that I think govern here. In cases dealing with education, and particularly higher education, the cases all allow for some deference to academic decision makers, recognizing that people in Dr. McNeese's and Dr. Lowe's position have to make a difficult judgment call that courts may not be as well qualified on the facts to make. So there has to be some margin of error. There also, as we pointed out in our brief, has to be some recognition of the public interest that particularly a medical school, which is putting its imprimatur, its stamp of competence on someone to go out and hold other people's lives in his or her hands, the school has to have some margin of error to say we doubt that it would be worth it to allow this to go forward. Within that context, then, the courts look to see is the notice reasonable, is the timeliness reasonable, and is the opportunity reasonable. Not is it perfect, not did the student have the best opportunity or the opportunity to make the very best case available, only, first of all, did the notice allow someone in the relevant population, and we would agree the notice would be different for a third grader than for a professional school student. In this case, it seems that timing was the critical error that the court found, the Court of Appeals and the trial court. There are other errors they pointed to as cumulative, but the thing they feel that makes this one that's incurable is the timing. It's that the 18-day lapse of time from when he's alleged to have cheated and when he got the formal charges. Well, I'll try and finish with one sentence, and that is this. This case was triggered by the observation of proctors, but suppose it had been 6 weeks later a student came in to Dr. McNeese and said, I want to get something off my conscience. I helped Alan Thon cheat. Under the standards imposed by this court, we would be without power to do anything about the alleged cheating. So, thank you.
May I ask you one question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you say that more severe and punitive potential outcome, the more process would be due? In other words, an expulsion is obviously more severe than a temporary suspension or some other interim-type punishment.
If that is the only difference between two situations, severity of outcome is one among the standards. It is not the only one. For example, it's unquestioned that a academic dismissal, which may be a severe outcome, a permanent expulsion, requires less process than even a suspension if it's disciplinary. So that's one thing. The extent of the...
The one is punishment, the other
right.
is not.
Okay, but the severity, I suppose from the standpoint of the person who is foreclosed from his career, that's a fine distinction. The outcome... I think
consequences may be the same as far as someone's ability to pursue their education is concerned. One who fails to meet academic standards as a condition of being there must meet those academic standards, does not do it, and loses their right to be there as a result. It's entirely different from someone who has excelled in most cases in those academic standards and then is accused of academic dishonesty and punitively dismissed. They're whole different cases.
Right.
One requires no process at all.
They
the other
differ.
Requires something.
Right. They differ. In that extent, other factors that have been weighed or the nature of the interest at stake. That's why there is some inquiry, at least, as to the extent of a property interest. And what it seems most courts have done in that case is say, we don't need to decide property interest because in this case, whatever process might be due for a property interest was satisfied, and that's our position, that it's satisfied, that therefore you don't need to. And there are other interests, but the severity of the outcome, we would argue, yes, it is one factor to be taken into account. It does not always outweigh the other factors, I guess, and in this case, would be the short response to that.
Mr. Todd, yes, your prayer for relief is that the Court of Appeals judgment be reversed and that we hold that there was no violation of due process rights and, in effect, affirm suspension or expulsion. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
You have an alternative prayer for relief. Right. Failing that, are you asking us to remand to the trial court for fashioning of an appropriate remedy and rescinding the permanent injunction? Can you articulate a little bit more of what you have in mind in that alternative prayer?
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, what that would amount to, if indeed the conclusion is that due process has been violated, order that the process, that there be a hearing that comports with due process, and in conjunction with that, I would simply say that if there are some harms to be suffered by the passage of time, I would simply note no effort was ever made to get a temporary restraining order to hold a second hearing, that within 6 months of the allegedly defective hearing, the plaintiff went in and obtained a TRO to get him back in school, but no effort was made to order a due process hearing at the time, so that I would say that if there are some disadvantages from the passage of time in doing a new due process hearing, the plaintiff ought to bear some of that. And, of course, the school also bears some disadvantage from the passage of time because it has to depend on witnesses as well. But what we're asking in the alternative relief is to is rather than force a degree on someone about whom the school has expressed meaningful doubts, instead order the process to be done again, and perhaps in equity the court might have to make some adjustments on how this is conducted to recognize the passage of time, but the remedy for due process is due process.
As I understand the facts, Mr. Fan denied he cheated, the statistical analysis was inconclusive, and you have two proctors says he appeared to them he cheated. What was the basis of the university's denial of his request to retake the exam?
I appreciate the opportunity to respond. The record does not reveal any instance, and I would just report, I don't know of any instance, in which Mr. Thon asked to retake the test. Now, there were many confidential discussions of ways, as Mr. Cohen said, of resolving the case outside of litigation. I don't know all the details of those. Those are confidential, but I do not believe the record shows, and I'll stand corrected if it does, any instance in which he asked to retake the examination. That may well be, might have at one point been a useful remedy, set up a cheat-proof circumstance and let him retake it, but I think that opportunity was passed, and I don't believe the record shows him ever asking for that.
Might that be a reasonable remedy in the trial court?
I think,
opposed to a cold hearing with departed witnesses?
The problem with that is that initially, if we're going to give some deference to academic decision makers, that is a remedy that theoretically the school had available. It had a wide range, and a medical school is in a real dilemma and a difficult situation faced with a good student accused of cheating. What is your ethical obligation? What do you do? One possible outcome is, if it had been proposed by the student, allow the retaking. That certainly wasn't requested in the hearing, and I think for the trial court to have room, I'm not completely ruling it out, but I pose this problem. To what extent do we want our courts to be
rather than reviewing for due process the fairness of the process, instead the third level of academic review after the dean and the president of the school. I think that's opening courts to a bigger burden than upon reflection they really want to take on.
Now, there you go. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court will take another brief recess.
Yes.